Okay, welcome to Myth Part 2, officially. Okay, so last time we talked about Near Eastern myths, creation stories, the creation of the world, the creation of gods, the creation of people, and the relations of gods and people, the Great Flood, and Gilgamesh, the first hero story. That sets the pattern for Greek myths. The Greeks borrowed some of that, it turns out. And today we'll talk about the similar Greek stories. Okay, let's say one thing about who the Greeks are and where they came from, but just a little bit. We won't do the whole history, but we need to know what centuries we're talking about. Where does Greek civilization come from? The Greeks are different people from these Near Eastern cultures we talked about. The Greeks came into Greece at some point as part of the Indo-European migration. This means that the people in ancient India, whose language was Sanskrit, and also Persia, and these are the Aryans, that's where the term Aryan came from, these ancient civilizations of India and Persia are related to most European civilizations. Greeks, Romans, the Celts, or Celts, Germans, Slavs, almost everybody in Europe came in this migration called Indo-European. The ancient Indians and Iranians, too, and the European ancestors. And this is a language family that was discovered in the late 1700s, because at that time, and there's a whole story about this, which is not a myth, the British were ruling India, and the British, of course, all learned classics, and the way to get a good job in the British Empire was to do well in Latin and Greek at Oxford or Cambridge. This was the route to power and wealth and success. Classics. And so the administrators of British India knew Greek and Latin, and one of them, William Jones, saw that he could read Sanskrit, that it was very close to Greek and Latin. And this gave rise to the theory of Indo-European. It's a language family. That all these languages are related because they have a common ancestor, and that spread through some migrations. Okay, this is how the Greeks entered Greece. And it's also why Greek and Latin are similar, not because one comes from the other, but they both derive from a common ancestor. So Greek and Latin would be like sibling languages. And this is why Greek myths are sometimes similar to ancient Indian myths or Germanic myths or Roman myths. So it's one way to study comparative mythology. Indo-European, there's some ancestry of the Greeks. Now we don't know enough about that because that's very prehistoric, but sometimes it helps to explain. Sometimes we'll see that. Okay, so when was this migration of the Greeks coming into Greece? This was in prehistory. The standard date is around 2200 BC, but that's not really well-founded. It's based on some things found in archaeology in Greece at that time, and somebody now thinks this maybe happened around 5500 BC with the spread of agriculture, the languages spread. So that just shows how open and unknown it still is. Sometime in those early centuries. Okay, the Greeks came into Greece, and then when we talk about Greek civilization, what centuries are we talking about? Right? That's right, that's one. And there's many. This is also about 2,000 years. Right? When we do ancient history, we do thousands of years, and actually many different civilizations, a whole world. So the first great civilization in Greece, the Greek civilization, is called Mycenaean. Have you been to Greece? Have you ever been to Mycenae? Right? The palaces. So that, when is that? That's the Bronze Age in Greece, the Greek mainland. And the Bronze Age is roughly 3,000 to 1,000 BC in round numbers. The late Bronze Age in Greece is the period we're talking about. It's in the late Bronze Age, which is 1600 to 1200 BC, that these palaces arise in Greece and the first great Greek civilization. And it's called Mycenaean because Mycenae is one of the main places and the one really discovered first by Heinrich Schliemann, who also found Troy. So this Mycenaean period is a period of palaces at Mycenae and other places around Greece. Actually, if you go to Athens, there's a Mycenaean palace, meaning a Mycenaean period palace from the late Bronze Age. There's fortification walls on the Acropolis at Athens, but you'd have to kind of know to look for it. So even that was a palace in this period, although there's no traces of the palace anymore. It's been so built over. But all the Mary Queen were these palaces. And this is when the hero stories are set. This is when the heroes lived. In other words, later they told stories that were supposed to be about this period. Kings in palaces. It turns out the hero stories seem to have originated in this period. But we don't have much writing from that time. This is still prehistoric. They had a writing system called Linear B, where each sign was a syllable. And this was actually deciphered in the 50s in a great story by a British architect, Michael Ventris, who did it in his spare time. And he found that this was an early way to write Greek using syllables before they had an alphabet. There were unknown signs before, but he cracked it using code-breaking methods. And so they had this writing system, but there are no myths on there. There's no literature, really. It's lots of tablets and accounting systems and interesting things, but not for myth or history that much. So what happened was this period fell. Around 1200 BC, there are destructions all around Greece and actually all around the Aegean Sea and the Eastern Mediterranean. There were some invaders, probably, and it's another big problem that's debated a lot that we could talk about, be interesting. But this period came to an end. The Bronze Age came to an end with violent destructions. So Greece fell into a dark age from, say, 1200 or 1100 BC to close to 800 BC. For centuries, Greece had a dark ages when they were illiterate. They did not have writing. They didn't have cities. The palaces were gone. They did not have an advanced social structure. So Greek civilization really arose again around 800 BC. And there was kind of a renaissance called the Renaissance of the 8th century BC. In the 8th century BC, there was a big population boom in Greece. And it's really the rise of a new civilization because cities arose. Cities means you have citizens, people have houses, you have streets, you have a common meeting place, you all get together and build a temple. That's a common focus for the community. So it's a city, and the word for that is polis, P-O-L-I-S. What word do we get from that in English? Politics comes from that. And one interesting thing about studying the Greeks is that you see the origins of all these things we take for granted. They invented politics in a certain way. Also, the alphabet comes from this time. Our alphabet comes from the Greek alphabet, ultimately. And the Greeks got the alphabet in the 8th century B.C. So that's part of this renaissance. Cities, population expansion. And with increasing activity, they were actually going to trade. And they went to trade over in the Near East, Syria, Phoenicia. Where's Phoenicia today? Lebanon. And they adopted the alphabet from them. They borrowed their alphabet, but they changed it because they added vowel signs and others. They added a few other signs. And this is the beginning of the Greek alphabet, also in the 700s BC. And that means they could write down their myths. So this is the beginning of Greek literature. Now they had the alphabet, and you could write down the poems of Homer or this other poet, Hesiod, who's also great and important, but not such a household word. Right? And this is what we'll start with, his account. So this means that the Greeks could set down their traditional stories sometime around 700 BC. But these stories went way back. They were centuries older. They were handed down from the Bronze Age all through the Dark Ages when they were illiterate. How were they passed down? You know, through oral tradition, oral poetry. They memorized them and passed them down. And actually, they was changed a little bit in the telling. Remember Roots, right? Alex Haley, right? That turned out a lot of that was made up by his informant, right? Anyway, that kind of thing, it turns out it always changes every century. They memorize it, but the poetry is helps to remember it, right? The poetry is in meter. Poetry came before prose also, something that's surprising. And they didn't have prose yet. So that's the first literature in Europe, Homer and Hesiod. So all these things arose in the 8th century, and by the way, that's when the Olympic Games began. So they set down these stories, although these are stories about heroes who lived centuries earlier in this great time of palaces that we call the Bronze Age. Okay, so from, say, 700 on, Greek civilization arose, the civilization of cities, and the historical civilization. So the development of Athens and Sparta. And somebody said, when is the great age of Athens? What do you think of first when you think of classical Greece, the height of Athens? It's the 5th century BC, right? That's when Athens developed an empire, built the Parthenon, they built up the Acropolis using the money from their empire. That's when all the Greek tragedies were written, because they were all written and performed in Athens, actually in an open theater under the Acropolis, on the slope of the Acropolis. That was very social and public, by the way. All of this art and poetry and theater was outdoors. And the basis of tragedy was also myth. Almost all the tragedies were about myths, who were about these heroes who lived in this long ago time, who were kings in places like Mycenae, Thebes, from the Bronze Age. Actually, all the surviving tragedies except one are about mythical themes. Okay, so myth was everywhere as part of their culture. By the way, when you saw temples in Greece, the temples were dedicated with sculptures, and these sculptures were all about gods and heroes. They were all about myth. So it was central to the culture for all of these times, and those are the main centuries to have in mind. That many of our literary sources are from the 5th century, because that's the age of Athens and the great age of literature, so-called classical age, when we have so many written works from Athens. But first we'll start with this earlier period of Homer and Hesiod. Okay, so let's go to that. We won't do all the history, but we'll see some of that as it comes up. Okay? Is that okay for a little outline? Right? Okay. So for the Greek account of creation, we have a poem by Hesiod, who is about contemporary with Homer, but the Greeks weren't really sure. Hesiod is about 700 BC, so that's about the earliest European literature there is. And he wrote a few poems, and one is called Theogony, meaning the birth of the gods. And this is the account of creation. It explains cosmogony, the birth of the universe, which includes the birth of the gods. And we know from last time that might include cosmology. How is that different? Cosmology is how the world works. Okay, so the Greeks themselves thought this. Homer and Hesiod taught the Greeks about the descent of the gods. That's what Herodotus said in the 5th century. Herodotus is called the father of history because he wrote the first surviving work of history. And in fact, it's about the first great prose work from the West. So, now one thing is that we're going to follow this account of creation. Hesiod's account in Theogony and another poem he wrote called Works and Days. But this doesn't mean it was the Bible of the Greeks. The Greeks did not have one canonical account. These are his poems. This is his version. He was a poet who traveled around Greece like Homer, and these poems became famous and pan-Hellenic. That means they spread around Greece beyond an individual city. But the Greek religion was very complicated. Different cities had their own deities, and there were different cults with their own creation accounts. So there are a number of more creation accounts that we know, right? This just became kind of the famous one through the force of his poetry. And another thing about that, Greece was never one country, right? There was no such thing as Greece until the 19th century as a political unity, a nation state. This was an invention of the 19th century, the nation state. Ancient Greece was a patchwork. Every city was independent. Athens was a city-state. Sparta was a separate state. It was dotted around with cities which were all independent states and fighting each other. So that's another reason why they might have different accounts, a great variety, both of in space and in time. Okay, so they never had one thing like a Bible. This is as close as it gets to being the well-known version that the Greeks knew from the poetry. Okay, so let's go to his account. This has the general pattern we saw before, that you go, to explain creation, that you go from chaos to cosmos. You start out with an early stage when things are undifferentiated, some kind of primal blob, an undifferentiated mass, whatever that is, and chaos is a general term for that, and then out of that develop differentiated bodies and some order called cosmos, the ordered universe. And then you have different generations of gods until one wins and establishes order. It seems that Hesiod knew these ancient Near Eastern stories and had some influence from them. This could have happened in the 8th century BC when the Greeks were rising again, or some people think it could have happened in the Bronze Age, which is the other great period when they had contact with the East. We don't really know when that borrowing came. Maybe in Hesiod's own time. Okay, so what comes first in Hesiod's account? Chaos, actually. He calls it chaos. That's the Greek word. Chaos came first. First was chaos. He doesn't say where it came from. And that would be pretty impossible, because then there would be something before it, right? So we always have to start a creation accounts with something a little bit unknown, right? Chaos came first. Four elements just kind of come into being. Chaos in Greek means like a gap, a void, a yawning space. It's like it's similar, related to the word chasm, etymologically. Then came Gaia. Gaia is earth as a woman. So that's a goddess, the earth personified. It's like the word ge, which is the Greek word for earth, gay, as in geology. Third came Tartarus. Tartarus is the depths of the earth. It's the roots of the earth. It's a little unusual why it came here so early. Tartarus is in below Hades. Okay, if this is the earth, Tartarus is all the way down the roots of the earth. He said, if you fall for 9 days, and the 10th day you hit Tartarus. That's the bottom of everything. That's as far down as heaven is up. Actually, if you do physics and measure the acceleration, you know, for 10 days, you can calculate how far that is, right? But of course, 9 and 10 are just kind of mythical numbers, right? So that's the roots of everything, Tartarus. And fourth came Eros. Now it gets a little more interesting, because Eros means what? Love. And Greek love is a little different than just love. Eros means desire. It's more of a force. It's a strong force, like an instinct. It's this overpowering desire. It's a little different than love, because you can love your pet, you can love your plant, you can love your mythology book, right? So love means affection for us. Eros means desire. And it's something people have in human nature. We have these instincts. But first, it's in the universe. It's a force of the universe for the Greeks. That's why when we say human nature, it's part of nature, right? So Eros comes forth, and that makes things possible, because Eros brings things together. And then two things can come together and mate and reproduce. So you need a force here to get everything going. How do you explain how other things come out of these? Well, he explains it like people. Two things come together and mate and reproduce like men and women. So it's this image of human reproduction to explain the creation of the first elements of the universe after these first four, which just kind of pop up with that much explanation. So there's a few more, we'll say the main steps. First is actually some unisexual generation. Some of these four just give birth out of themselves. Chaos gives birth to night and darkness, and night gives birth to day. Our night comes before day because there's some progress here. The older ones look a little wilder, and the more orderly ones progress. Out of it is this whole pattern. Okay, Gaia gives birth to Uranus. What do these two words mean? Gaia is Earth. What's Uranus? Or Uranus, the same word as the planet, since our planets are Greek gods, right? You know what that word means? Sky. It means sky. So Earth gives birth to sky. And now you get the first ruler of heaven. He's the first ruling God, heaven himself, since heaven means sky. Okay, Gaia and Uranus mate. And they're the first rulers of heaven. They're going to be three major generations. Them, I'll say what they are first. Earth and heaven rule first, and then the children, the Titans, and then their children, Zeus and his friends, the Olympians, right? So that's the progression of these three generations, and this is the first one first. Earth and heaven mate. Right? And they have various children. These include the three Cyclops. Cyclops are one-eyed giants who are also smiths. They're metal workers. The Greek is actually Cyclopes, E-S. That's the Greek plural. So the word Cyclops is singular, by the way. They have these other three characters called the 100-handers, who each have 50 heads and 100 hands. Notice it's pretty wild. At first you have these elements of nature, like earth and sky, and then all these wild, like monsters. And they also give birth to the 12 Titans, their children, who are this early race of gods, who are 6 male and 6 female Titans. We don't need to name every one. The youngest Titan is Cronus. But there's a little problem here, because they give birth to these Titans, but they're still inside Mother Earth. They can't get out and really be born into the light. Why is that? Because Earth is still mating with heaven. Heaven is on top of Earth. Heaven and Earth are locked in perpetual intercourse. Right? Uranus and Gaia. So the children can't get out of Earth. So partly this story is going to explain how heaven and earth are separated. Don't we always need that? Right? In Babylonian, we had something like that. Now this hasn't happened yet, but that's what's coming up. They have to be split. So the Greeks will have a cute story. We saw a story already that you had the primal waters and Tiamat was split. Or in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, God separated the waters into upper and lower waters. So all people have something like that. In Egypt, they also have earth and sky together, and then they're split. Although in Egypt, by the way, it's backwards. Sky is female, and earth is male. Maybe the opposite of what you expect. Herodotus said the Egyptians do everything backwards. And we went through all these examples about that. But there are beautiful, actually, paintings of that if you go to Egypt, in the tombs. Okay, so again, earth and heaven are not yet separated. How do they become separated? Well, the children are being oppressed. And Gaia doesn't like this. So in other words, the father is looking oppressive, Uranus is looking bad, and becomes worse in this story. And that's all about the older gods looking a little wilder, and the younger gods replacing them. So, Earth makes a sickle and gives it to Cronus. Cronus, it says, hated his father who was wicked. So he ambushes the father with the sickle and castrates him. So that causes a separation of sky and earth. Right? So they're not locked in intercourse anymore. Right? Now it turns out this sickle is used in some early Near Eastern stories. They use a sickle to separate heaven and earth. But the Greek story makes it more human, kind of comical, and more anthropomorphic. And actually, let me jump to another slide here. Okay, that's what we're saying. Where do we see this sickle today? Who carries that sickle today? Father Time. That's the same sickle. The sickle Cronus used for this cosmic separation and castration Okay, calling Dr. Freud here, right? The son castrating the father, replacing the father, the Oedipal complex, there it is. Well, Cronus' name is a name, Cronus. But it looks like the Greek word for time, chronos, with a ch, as in chronology, the measuring of time. So, in ancient times, these became confused, and basically it's because they were thinking about myths too much, and they said Cronus, he means time. And that was kind of over-interpretation based on this accidental similarity of the names, really, because it's not the same name. But that's how Father Time got the sickle. And there he is on a laptop in that slide. Okay. So let's just go back. Okay. So Cronus castrates his father, Sky, and throws the genitals into the sea. Well, some of the blood goes into the ground and gives birth to some creatures out of the ground, since the blood is like a seed in the earth. Some of the Furies, who you see in Greek myths. The Furies are these primitive deities. They're not fully human, because they're wilder from these earlier times. And also this bizarre bush makes them a little wilder. And the Furies are like these ghosts almost, or shades. If you kill someone related to you, they hound you. This comes up in a famous Greek tragedy. The Furies haunt you for killing kindred blood, or having that on your hands. And they also give birth to the giants. The giants came out of the blood going into the earth, this race of giants. Remember, by the way, last time we mentioned that in the Hebrew Bible, it mentions a race of giants in early times on earth. The Nephilim. Well, then the genitals went into the sea. Who is born out of the genitals? Aphrodite herself, the goddess of love, is born from her father's severed, castrated genitals, right? So does that make sense for the goddess of love to come out of that part of the body? It's not unrelated, right? That's fertility, right? Funny enough, she's born from a male, which you have in some of these stories, that men can be the fertility, you know, to come from the male alone. We don't think of it that way today, I don't think. So Aphrodite grew up out of the foam in the sea, and then she wafted onto one island and then it landed on another island, and this is art of that. The story about the foam seems to come from her name. Aphros is the word for foam. So it seems that they made up this story about the foam just to explain her name. And maybe her name is just a name, but they try to make it make sense. So myths can develop to, you know, try to explain a name like that. It seems like the myth came later. In other words, maybe she's born a different way. That's a made-up story. Okay. And here she is rising from the sea, and Botticelli's Venus on the half shell. Okay, and she landed on one island, Kythera, and then she landed on Cyprus. So both those islands gave her names. Actually, she's called the Cyprian woman, or the Kytherian. Sometimes they use those words for her. She's associated with those islands. And Cyprus is close to the Near East, by the way, and it wasn't always Greek. That's where supposedly she came up to Earth when she was born. She's called the Cyprian, and this is saying something about her nature, that she's somewhat Near Eastern. She's partly borrowed from Inanna, Ishtar, Astarte, these older goddesses of love and war. So when she's born on Cyprus, and her main cults are on Cyprus, this was Near Eastern place and not Greek at first. You know, still today it's Turkish and Greek, so that's a border area. She has these Eastern elements. That sort of refers to her Eastern nature. Okay, Cronus becomes the leader of the Titans, and now they rule. That's the second generation of the rulers in heaven, or the ruling gods. Cronus is the leader with his sister Rhea. Cronus and Rhea marry. I can flip back here to show you some of the other names of the Titans. One is Ocean. One is Hyperion, who's the father of the sun and the moon. One is Iapetus, who's the father of Prometheus and Atlas. And Iapetus is actually mentioned in Hebrew. There's a son of Noah called Japheth. Well, what is Iapetus? That's Greek for Japheth. How that's related is interesting but puzzling, right? But it's clearly the same name. And there's a woman named Memory, who's the mother of the Muses later on, and Themis, Law. So some of these are abstract concepts, and we won't say them all. The Titans weren't all bad, although later on they got a bad press, right? So from this earlier time, the gods are a little wilder, and there are more monsters born. Most of the monsters of Greek myth are born from this time. They represent an earlier stage of creation that's more threatening, less fully developed. So here's an example. Gaia gives birth to these monsters. Gaia mates with Pontus, which means sea. That was her own son. And they have all these monsters. The Sphinx. And these are monsters because they're not natural. The Sphinx is a mixture of three animals called a hybrid animal. This is actually something that's found in Mesopotamian and Near Eastern art that the Greeks probably got from the Near East. This idea of hybrid animals. Because we know, of course, this famous Sphinx from Egypt. The Chimera, Gorgons like Medusa, Cerberus is a three-headed dog that guards Hades. The Hydra is a 50-headed dragon, a sea serpent. The Harpies are these bird women who snatch food from people. So there are various more, and some of these will come up in hero stories. So let's just say now that these various monsters are born in earlier times. They represent this earlier, less developed, threatening, early stage. But one thing about the Greeks is that these things are always around. Sometimes they'll appear on Earth and a hero has to fight them. These things are always around from earlier times. You can't kill them off. Totally. Because they thought the world was always a mixture of evil and good. Right. So that's what we'll see. We'll see more of that, how that plays out. Okay, back to the Titans rule, the second generation of the ruling gods. Cronus and Rhea have six children. But also the father is oppressive to these children. Cronus is jealous that one of his children will overthrow him the way he overthrew his own father. So what does he do when the children are born? He swallows them. And these are Hestia, which means hearth, better known from Latin. Vesta is the Latin of her name. And in Rome, you have the famous Vestal Virgins, who are priestesses of Vesta, who represents the hearth that is the sacred fire. In Greece, she never became as important. Okay. And Demeter, Hera, Hades, and Poseidon. Cronus swallows them as soon as they're born. What's another name for Cronus, by the way, in Latin, do you know? Saturn. He's Saturn. Well, Zeus is born, the youngest. And the mother protects him. Rhea protects him. She gives Cronus a stone wrapped in baby clothes. And he swallows that thinking he's swallowing Zeus. And Rhea spirits Zeus off to Crete, where he's raised in a cave by nymphs. And they stand outside the entrance of the cave banging cymbals to make noise so nobody hears the baby crying, since Cronus might be all-seeing. And actually, if you go to Crete, you can see the cave where Zeus was raised. It's this holy cave where they made many offerings. Okay. So here's a slide of Saturn devouring the children. That's from the Renaissance. I think that might be Raphael. And this one is by Goya. Right? who did these paintings of horrors at the time of the Napoleonic Wars in Spain, you know? Okay, so that's Cronus or Saturn. Well, how did Zeus overthrow him? So Zeus arose and grew up, and he defeated Cronus, although we don't have the story about how he did that. But he forced Cronus to vomit up the children, and then they come out of him again, like a rebirth out of the father, but they come in the opposite order, so now Zeus is kind of the first, because the stone comes out first. And now, here is the very stone that Cronus swallowed and then vomited up in place of Zeus. There it is in the slide. Because the Greeks put that at Delphi to mark the center of the earth. And it's there, and it was found in the middle of the temple at Delphi, and you can see it in the museum. That's proof, right? That happened. And that's called the omphalos. Omphalos means the belly button, the navel. It marked the navel of the earth, which was at Delphi. Well, the famous oracle was the Temple of Apollo with the Oracle of Apollo. And it was a sacred stone, of course, right? Okay, now Zeus and his siblings have to defeat the Titans. And this is how they become the ruling deities, and their generation are the Olympians. Notice this is only the first six Olympians, not all 12 yet. Well, the Titans are arrogant. And there's a big battle called the Titanomachy, the Battle of the Titans, that lasts 10 years. Gaia, Earth, tells Zeus that to win he needs the 300-handers. So he has to release them from Tartarus, where they were in prison. And he also gets the Cyclops on his side, and he promises them more rewards and privileges if they'll help him. And the Cyclops make the thunderbolt for Zeus. So he uses this to blast the earth. And these 100-handers, these three characters from earlier times, they cast the Titans down into prison. And where do they go in prison? All the way down to Tartarus, the roots of the earth, the bottom of everything. A 10 days fall from Earth. Tartarus is the prison of the Titans. They're in a bronze fortress with bronze walls and a guard there so they can never get out. So they're still there, right? Because they're immortal. Did anybody see the Hercules movie from Disney?
Yeah.
Right? Remember it starts out that the Titans are going to come out to defeat Zeus again. Okay, so now Zeus has won, and he becomes the ruler of heaven. One of the first things he does is punish Atlas, who was the son of a Titan. He punishes Atlas by making him hold up the sky. But you need that at this point. Zeus has to establish order. Remember, it's progressive move towards order. So you have to hold up the sky, so that Uranus cannot fall back down on Gaia and go back to that earlier state. Just like in the Bible, it said God separated the upper into upper and lower waters and put up something to hold it up. So that's what Atlas does. He actually keeps this cosmic separation to keep order and to work for Zeus, who oversees order. By the way, okay, that's what Atlas is doing. He's holding up the sky. So we can't have, you know, Chicken Little, the sky falling down. But how has that changed? What do you see Atlas doing today? He's holding up the earth. That's a lot different, right? That's a change. And maybe it happened something like this, right? They said Atlas held up the world, and later on, you know, people took that to be just the earth. It's kind of a misunderstanding. And there are the Titans imprisoned in Tartarus by William Blake, who was interested in that kind of thing and made many biblical drawings and drawings of mythology that look kind of the same. He made them into kind of biblical themes. Okay, that's the first battle of the Titanomachy. Zeus has defeated the Titans. But it's not over yet. Zeus has two other major battles that he has to win. And these are battles of the bad guys, monsters, these wild things that come in that Zeus has to defeat to maintain order. Because the Greeks thought that we're in a constant battle with evil or disorder. Okay? So the second one is that now Gaia, the Earth, turns against Zeus. So by the way, just because she's the Earth and the mother and the earlier mother of the deities doesn't mean she's all good. The Greeks were not utopian about that. At one point she helps Zeus in the first battle, and the second one she turns against him and creates this monster named Typhoeus, also called Typhon, to battle Zeus. We saw that with Tiamat, actually, in the Mesopotamian, that these early Earth mother figures can be good or bad because that's life. That's what nature does to you, right? So Typhoeus is created from Gaia and Tartarus. And he's a monster, a dragon. I mean, an enormous snake. Sometimes it says he has 100 heads and he spits fire. So this is to, by these earlier deities, to try to defeat Zeus. Zeus has a major battle. They chase each other around. And actually the details of this story show that the Greeks borrowed this story from older Near Eastern stories. And there's Typhoeus in art and Zeus defeating him. And that's clearly the good guy versus the bad guy. Or for the Greeks, that's like, of course, order versus disorder or civilization against barbarism, right? And Zeus puts Typhoeus under a mountain in Sicily, Mount Etna. What is Mount Etna known for? What does this explain, right? It's volcanic. Why is it volcanic? Typhoeus is trapped underneath. Typhoeus may bellow up at any time. Right? So that story is the etiology, where this volcano comes from. And etiology is a myth that explains the cause of something in the world. But this is also typical about this Greek worldview, that Zeus defeats Typhoeus. Okay, that's progress. That maintains order. But you cannot kill Typhoeus and eliminate him. He's underground, and he might come back. So this is why you have to pray to Zeus and be pious. You always need Zeus to maintain this order and battle the evil elements, right? That the Greeks thought these older, wilder deities might still be around. You have to trample them underfoot. At this point, okay, before his third battle, Zeus has a wife named Metis. A wife might be overstating it. Zeus has a woman, and he gets her pregnant. Metis means cleverness, craftiness. This is a typical Greek virtue, right? The mind. Well, Metis is pregnant, but Zeus has a prophecy that her child will be greater than its father. Oh no! Right? Zeus did it to his father, Cronus did it to his father. When is this going to stop? So Zeus swallows Metis, the mother. Right? And by the way, you know the crazy Roman Emperor Caligula? He thought he was Zeus and he did something like this. His wife was pregnant and he thought he was Zeus. And I think he killed her, actually. I think he ran a sword through her pregnant belly, I think. And actually, in the movie, it shows him with bloody lips like he tried to eat something. It's gross. But So some people took this as an allegory, that Zeus swallowed cleverness, meaning Zeus has cleverness inside him. Right. Because for the Greeks, you're not supposed to just be strong and powerful in body. It's not like this cartoon strong man, but you have to be clever in mind as well. So then, what happened to the babies Metis was pregnant with? Well, Zeus has a bad headache. And out of his head is born Athena. Athena is born fully grown and fully armed from the head of Zeus. By the way, last time Marduk was born fully grown as well, in Babylonian. And this explains something about Athena. She's very masculine. She was a warrior. Nowadays we say Athena is wisdom. It wasn't really that simple. You can't say a Greek god is one thing. There were many sides. And her main thing was that she was a warrior. She wasn't actually all wisdom. It's not that simple. Although her mother being Metis helps there. But she was a warrior first of all. Armed. And also she's masculine. She doesn't have a mother. The mother's been eliminated. She's born from a man. So she's very masculine, not a typical female role for Athena. By the way, who's that god in the slide there with the axe?
Prometheus.
Well, somebody else, actually. That's the smith. Who's the worker god? Hephaestus. Actually, we haven't had him come in yet. He split Zeus's head with the axe. We'll see the gods later. All these new generation of Zeus and the Olympians. Here are other slides of the birth of Athena. Right? Here she is, armed. She's always got the helmet, shield, and spear. Here she is. In art, by the way, the figures with white skin are females and dark skin are male. Do you know about that? You see that in ancient art. It's a convention. It's actually found back in Bronze Age art. In Minoan art from Crete in the Bronze Age, and I think from Egypt. I'm not certain about that, though. But you see this typical thing in Greek and Roman art and earlier, because there's a social reason for that. The men worked outside, and they got tans. And women were supposed to have this, you know, gender prejudice that the women kept the private realm, the house, the family, children, and also, you know, religion and other things. But it was thought to be the sign of an upper-class woman to stay inside and not have to work outside. So they looked all white, and Roman women would actually paint themselves white to look more upper-class, like that they didn't have to work. So something like that, maybe is why they're white skin. People called the Greeks dead white males and things like that. And I said, no, they're dead, well-tanned males. So by the way, now we've had two deities, two of the Olympians, Aphrodite and Athena, who were born from males only, right? In Hittite, there's a story of one of the male sky gods who gives birth through his penis to the next male god. So, okay, so now, we won't go into that. Now, Zeus has one more battle, a third battle for him to fight off these monsters and maintain his supremacy. Now is the battle of the gods and the giants, or the gigantomachy. And this is a popular subject in Greek art, if you see temple decoration. But there's not many literary stories about this. The giants are from earlier times, when Uranus was castrated and some blood went into the earth and gave rise to a race of giants. Well, they rear up, urged by Gaia, Earth, so that's the older gods trying to come back, very similar to the Mesopotamian story last time, older versus younger. And the giants attack the Olympians. There's a long battle, we don't have much of a story about that, and Heracles is needed for Zeus to win. Heracles is a son of Zeus and a demigod, a hero, whose story we'll see later. So now we're advancing in time when the Olympians fight together, and even a son of Zeus, Heracles or Hercules, aids Zeus, and they defeat the Titans, and at that point, Zeus and two of his brothers cast lots for what realms each one will get. Zeus, Hades, and Poseidon. Zeus gets the sky. Of course, Hades, the underworld. Poseidon is the sea, but Poseidon is also the earth. Because it's never that simple. He's the sea. He's also earthquakes and these kind of powers of the earth. And they say that Olympus is common to them all, except Hades. Except for Hades, he's not supposed to come up to earth. He's not supposed to be seen at all. And now Zeus rules, and he's called the Cosmocrator, the ruler of the cosmos, who keeps order to keep all these other forces at bay. Notice there's no people yet. Where do you see this word today? Well, if you go to a Greek church, there's always a dome up above in the center, right? There's a dome that represents the heavens. Blue dome with the ruler of the universe looking down. Jesus. And Jesus is called the Pantocrator, the ruler of everything. It's a very similar word to Cosmocrator, ruler of the universe. So it was Zeus and now it's Jesus. Right? Can you picture that as a dome above a Greek church that represents the heavens? Since the whole church is kind of a microcosm. Okay, let's say a couple of things about the Greek creation stories. We kind of said already that there's this pattern from chaos to cosmos. The older deities are more like natural forces. Sometimes they're monstrous or wicked, or that comes out more in the stories, as Uranus and Cronus become oppressive. And sometimes they have children who are all these monsters. So they look wilder, and there's some progress from them to Zeus, who defeats them, but they can't be eliminated entirely, like we said, that they're still around. The Greeks are not optimistic about civilization winning out and conquering all evil. Sometimes we talk that way today, right? We're going to defeat all the bad guys. But a Greek view of the world is called the tragic view, that the world is always a mixture of good and bad, and civilization is always built over chaos, right? Civilization is built over Typhoeus and the Titans who are underground, and floods and all kinds of things can still come back. Okay. So it's a way partly of explaining that about the world. Okay, let's see. How are we? Let's take a break now, and then we will come to Greek Christian stories of people and Prometheus and Pandora and the first people, okay? Questions? Okay, now we have the first people and the stories of Prometheus and Pandora. These stories are mostly from Hesiod as well, who wrote a poem, Theogony, and another poem called Works and Days. Those are two main poems. Well, what about the creation of people? The Greeks don't really have a lot of stories about the creation of people. Actually, most of the sources are a lot later, and later authors, even Roman authors. And usually it's attributed to Prometheus. Who was Prometheus? Prometheus was the son of a Titan. His father is named Iapetus, who's the father of Prometheus and Atlas both. So as the son of a Titan, Prometheus is the same generation as Zeus, but he's not with Zeus and the Olympians, and he's a little bit is blanketed with the Titans who lost. His father Iapetus is the one we said is found in Hebrew, Japheth, the son of Noah. In Hebrew, Noah has three sons, and Japheth is the ancestor of the Europeans. So here in Greek, Iapetus is the Greek version of the same name. Now, the Greeks did not know the Hebrew Bible was never not that important around the outside world until Christianity spread it. So how are those similar? Maybe they go back to a common, older source behind both of those. That would just be guesswork. It's just a curious coincidence. Okay, so Prometheus. His name means forward thinker. Pro is forward, as in proactive, etc. And then his name also has in it Metis, as in that woman Zeus swallowed, cleverness, craftiness, which was a typical Greek virtue. Sometimes the Greeks praised trickery, by the way. There's a good trickery, right? Greeks are pretty much still proud of this, that they live by their wits because Greece is a poor country, like Odysseus, you know, that kind of thing. Anyway, that's in his name. It looks like his name means forward thinker. He created people from mud, meaning from dirt, ashes. that people are lonely, people are of earth, people are not like God. And, of course, we still have this in religion when people put ash on their foreheads at Ash Wednesday, right? And there's something more about this. That the way they describe creation was Prometheus making people out of clay. It was like the image of a potter taking clay and making a bowl out of it, a vase. In other words, pottery was the dominant technology, and so they used that image. How do you make people? It's like a craftsman making a vessel. Because I read this interesting book that said, we always use these kind of metaphors. Nowadays we say, what is the mind like? We don't understand the mind. And we'll say it's like a big information processing system. It's like a giant computer. So what are we doing? We're using this metaphor of the dominant technology to explain people. And they were doing something like that. And in the 19th century, they said, what are people like? They said, people are like steam engines. They have these pistons that can, your instincts go up and down. You got to fight them down. Sometimes you do things, you know. So I read that the image of pottery, the dominant technology at the time. And we still do that kind of thing. Okay. So, Prometheus was associated with people. And now you have a god who has some relation to people. But Zeus doesn't necessarily care about people. And that's how the story goes. Since the gods were not created for people, right? Well, at first, people and gods are dining together. They're having a banquet at this place called Mekone. And that's really just a name. This represents a stage before the fall of people from the gods. This is going to become like a fall of mankind story. First, the people are with the gods and close to the gods. They're dining together. That means you share a society. People are in the company of gods. Maybe God-like and not separated from the gods yet. What stage would that be? That's like the Garden of Eden, when they're like gods before they're expelled. Okay, so people are dining with the gods, and this is a story of how people fall out of that, called the Fall of Mankind story. Prometheus tricks Zeus. Prometheus is a trickster. His name suggests that, and he's a trickster figure like you see in various mythologies. He takes some bones wrapped in fat, and he says, I'll feed this to Zeus and make it look like something good and see if he can tell it's got bones inside. And the story is, well, Zeus knew, because Zeus has to be all-knowing. You have to say, of course, Zeus knew. But then he eats it, and he says, Prometheus, you tricked me, and he got mad. And he took it out on people who were Prometheus' favorites. Zeus planned a terrible future for mortal men. So this is a fall of mankind story. You go from dining with the gods, and because of this story, Zeus gets angry and banishes people from that state, like being expelled from the Garden of Eden. To explain the gap between people and gods. Gods are immortal, people are mortal. That's the Greek message. The Greeks didn't believe in salvation, that you could become immortal. So they're pessimistic or tragic in their view of the world. Well, this, and also it's saying that Zeus doesn't really care about people. Prometheus was close to people, but he champions people, but he fights Zeus because of that. Zeus is hard to people because the world is hard to people. The gods are not originally there for our benefit. And there's one more thing about this particular story about Prometheus feeding Zeus and tricking him with the bones wrapped in fat. That's the way the Greeks actually sacrificed. When they performed an animal sacrifice at an altar in real historical times, the Greeks would eat the meat and divide it among themselves. It's actually one of the only times they had meat in the diet, because they would have these feasts throughout the year. And what did they give to the gods on the altar? The thigh bone wrapped in fat. And so this is a story of the first sacrifice. Why do we do that? Because Prometheus did that. So this story is an etiology of sacrifice. The fact is, the Greeks didn't really remember why they did that anymore. They didn't know. And it's ritual, and later on they make up a story to try to explain it. Like we try to make up stories why we do Halloween or Valentine's Day or Thanksgiving, and we forgot what the ancient origins are of those things. Or Christmas. So, Zeus punished people because of this, because they were Prometheus' favorite. Zeus removes fire from people. He doesn't care about people. Prometheus went and stole it back. He stole fire from heaven and carried it down to earth and gave it to people. Well, this helped people a lot. This made human progress possible. Fire. Fire made possible metalworking, cooking, heating your house. So they thought Prometheus was a champion of culture. He became a culture hero. And they really played this up in one tragedy from 5th century Athens. There's a tragedy called Prometheus Bound by Aeschylus. And it says, all human arts come from Prometheus. Of course, Aeschylus is writing that in Athens, by the way, and he praises all these arts because he wants to say, look how Athens has all these arts. And where do you see Prometheus today? Where is this statue in the slide? Rockefeller Center. That's Prometheus bringing the fire. That's a symbol of progress. You can date that to around the 30s style, right? Kind of Art Deco type style, right? Is it? And here's the inscription on that statue in Rockefeller Center. Prometheus, teacher in every art, brought the fire that hath proved to mortals a means to mighty ends. Notice how the word hath is actually biblical there, right? How many people conflate the biblical and the Greek myth. Okay. Well, Zeus did not like this. The price for helping people is that Prometheus becomes a martyr. Zeus gets two henchmen, strength and force, to chain Prometheus up to a mountain cliff in the far east, in the Caucasus Mountains, where Prometheus has a perpetual punishment, the famous punishment of a vulture or an eagle eating at his liver every day. It grows back, and it's a perpetual torment. Keeps going back, keeps being eaten. And he's chained up to this cliff. Now, what does that make Prometheus like? He's somebody who helps people and is punished for it by being chained up like this. Right? Is he a Christ figure? Yes. Yes. This slide actually shows, okay, there's Prometheus on the right in the far east, chained up, and being eaten by a vulture or an eagle. Who's that on the left of the slide? Atlas, that's actually his brother. Atlas is in the far west. Do you know where Atlas was standing? We didn't say before. Where was Atlas standing and holding up the sky? He was standing by the Straits of Gibraltar. So the Greeks, that was the west, because that was the edge of the earth, and beyond that was ocean, and maybe ocean surrounded the earth all around, maybe it was water all the way. And maybe you went across the waters, you came to the islands of the gods, which you have in all kinds of stories, like we had last time, Dilmun, in their eastern stories. So Atlas is in the far west, Prometheus is in the far east, and they're brothers. And you can see them as kind of more punishments of the Titans, or children of the Titans, as well. By the way, in Morocco, there are mountains today called the Atlas Mountains. Still named from that. What else is named after Atlas? The ocean, right past where Atlas is, the Atlantic Ocean, is named after him. Right? Well, okay, that's Prometheus' punishment for helping people, showing that Zeus and the gods don't care about people, the world is hard for people. Eventually, Prometheus was freed many generations later. And we'll just say now, he was freed because he had a secret. He knew that one child would be born who might overthrow Zeus. That one child would be born who's greater than its father. So Zeus was going to mate with a certain woman, and Prometheus knew the secret that if Zeus does, the child will be greater than Zeus. And in return for Prometheus telling Zeus the secret who it was, and Zeus stayed away from that woman and married her off to someone else, in return for that secret, Zeus allowed Hercules to free Prometheus. much later. Well, let's say a couple more things about the Prometheus figure, because Prometheus has been a powerful figure in art and literature in the Western imagination, right? What is this? How does Prometheus come into the Frankenstein story? Do you know the full title of Frankenstein? The novel, Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus, by Mary Shelley in 1818. How is Frankenstein like Prometheus? Frankenstein is the doctor, of course. Does he use fire to create a person? Prometheus created people. Prometheus gave fire, meaning technology. But in this story, what happens? Prometheus is really a negative figure here, because Frankenstein creates a person, and Mary Shelley is warning about the dangers of technology and science getting out of control. That's her message there, that from that period. Her husband was the poet Percy Shelley, who wrote a long poem, Prometheus Unbound, in 1820. It's not about a book that's falling apart. It's and Prometheus there is somewhat spiritual, a god who cares about people. I wish no living thing to suffer pain. So Shelley liked Prometheus because Prometheus took on Zeus and took on the gods and cared about people. And Shelley was actually a free thinker, so-called. Shelley was kicked out of Oxford for being an atheist. He wrote a pamphlet called The Necessity of Atheism. And he was expelled for that. And so he liked this idea of Prometheus taking on Zeus and toppling the gods for in the name of human progress. So many people have picked up Prometheus because of that. Byron admired that. Karl Marx loved that idea. The poet Goethe wrote a great poem about Prometheus with that message. So there's a whole history of the Prometheus image. And then when you come to Rockefeller Center statue, it's an image of progress, a little more optimistic, hopes of science and technology. The Greeks, by the way, didn't have much technology, so when they talk about fire, it did not really refer to this kind of technology that the Prometheus figure got used for later. But especially in the Romantic era, he became a symbol of defiance and rebellion. In Milton's Paradise Lost, Satan is like Prometheus. Satan is like has all these Promethean features of his character rebelling from Zeus, and so on. Actually, there's a publisher in upstate New York called Prometheus Books. Has anybody come across them? What do they specialize in? They specialize in science and free thought, which is a polite word for criticizing religion. And they use Prometheus for that. Sorry? Okay. Now, also remember, Prometheus tried to help people, and Zeus punished him for helping people. And Zeus was going to punish people as well. It said, Zeus planned a terrible future for mortal men. Part of the fall of mankind theme that's going on here. People are first dying with the gods, and then fall out of that state into a life of suffering and pain and death. Similar to being expelled from the Garden of Eden. So, this is how Zeus punishes people. He sends Pandora. And it says this. This is from Hesiod's poem, Works and Days. He says, till then the human race had lived on earth far from all ills, without torment, pain, or dreadful disease. And it's a story about the origin of suffering, evil, the human condition, death. And of course, it blames on a woman, like, kind of like Eve. But really, well, really, it's the God sending it. The woman herself doesn't do it. Really, the God sent this. Because the gods can send hard things to you because the world and nature send hard things. Right? So the gods create the first woman, Pandora. Her name means all gifts. The gods endow her with different gifts. Zeus has Hephaestus, who's the worker god. He's the smith. It's very odd for a god to have to work and do manual labor. Hephaestus creates a woman from clay and water. What people are made from, like the potter image. All the gods endow her with gifts. Athena teaches her to work the loom. Hermes taught her thievish morals. Quote. I have to say this is a quote. Quotation. Thievish morals and the soul of a bitch. Quote. Okay. He filled her with lies, with swindles, all sorts of thievish behavior, a curse to men who eat bread. But she's beautiful on the outside. Right, alluring but dangerous inside. Now there's definitely a strain of misogyny in Greek literature, and it's a little bit of the can't live with, can't live without, you want it, but you know, careful what you want for, that kind of thing. The mixture of good and bad, that's typical Greek thought. Beautiful on the outside, but be careful what you want. It could be dangerous on the inside. And the whole point is the gods are sending these evils to earth. There's a side of the gods making her with Athena on the left and Hephaestus on the right. Where they send her to earth with a large jar full of all the evils in the world, suffering, diseases, all the evils. And this explains where these evils come from, an etiology. And actually she had a large jar, and this would have been like one of these big storage jars you see in Bronze Age archaeology. If you've been to Mycenae or Crete, there are these large storage vessels called the pithos that you could stand inside. It was one of these jars called the pithos. Today you always hear Pandora's box. And it doesn't matter that much, but just by the way, it wasn't a box. It became a box in the Renaissance because Erasmus translated it that way. He thought it was a cosmetics box. And that's why you hear that everywhere today. Well, it comes to Earth, and Prometheus has a dumb brother, his slower brother, Epimetheus. If Prometheus means forward thinker, what do you think Epimetheus means? Right? It's a little behind. Prometheus warns him, don't trust this, because again, the gods aren't all good. But Epimetheus marries her, she's beautiful outside. But this is trouble. Pandora opens the jar, and out come all the evils in the world, suffering, disease, lying, stealing. Remember Ghostbusters? Remember that scene in Ghostbusters? All the horrors are going to come out. Cats and dogs, raining blood, living together, right? Things like everything you can think of. Now, you could say, well, the woman is blamed, but really, it's the gods who send this. She's the vehicle, sure. She does, you know, she has a role there, but not the main cause. And Hesiod says, women, the curse of us mortal men, they live as a curse and cause of sorrow to mortal men. And he says, well, and so this poem, Works and Days, by the way, by Hesiod around 700 B.C. And it's called Works and Days because he gives you all kinds of advice about the agricultural season, when to farm, harvest, when to get married, all kinds of moral precepts, like a farmer's almanac. And so that's why he gets into talking about women and marriage, and he'll say, well, it's bad if you get married, it's bad if you don't. He says, but be careful to marry a good woman because a bad woman will just be out for your barn. But if you don't get married, then you have a lonely old age. So either way, you know, that's his point there, that life is hard. So everything comes out of the jar. And again, this explains the fall of mankind. Like in the Garden of Eden, you're in a state like the gods, and what happens? You're kicked out and you die. So now suffering and death and all the ills come to the world. Sent by the gods. One thing stays in the jar, though. Then she puts the lid back on the jar. Only hope remained in the jar. What does this mean? Is that good or bad? You can take it a couple of ways. The good news is there's hope there. But the bad news is it's in the jar with the lid on it, right? So there's no hope out released in the world. And this goes along with Greek pessimism. They didn't know if there was any hope. Hope was not a virtue for the Greeks. They would not name their daughters Faith, Hope, and Charity or anything like that. They did not have these virtues, right? They had different virtues, like bravery, wisdom, not, you know, courage. So here's the thing about hope. So I made up a little story about this that I'll just say briefly, maybe more later if we have time. The Greek story kind of ends there. This is the world as we know it. We don't know if we can get hope out of the jar, basically. They don't say how. They don't say if you're good, you can get hope and you can maybe dine with the gods again or something like that. It's just this is the way it is and it's not going to change. They didn't really believe in progress that much. They didn't have technology, so they didn't believe people could change conditions quite a bit. And they also didn't have a religion of salvation that, okay, God will save us all, we can all live forever. They didn't have that. So this is a contrast of what came later. With Christianity came and said, there is hope, God will send his son, and you can become a god, and you can get out of this world, and you will die, but you can go back to the Garden of Eden, you can go back to living like that, you can go back to the state before the fall. Christianity holds out that help of getting it back. At the very end of the Bible, you get that back, right? In the Bible, you have it in the beginning, you lose it, you spend the whole rest of the Bible trying to get it back, and at the very end, you're told how to get it back and eat the tree of life, right? With Jesus coming back and bringing the new world called the New Jerusalem, right? So that's the hope. And there's a hope of salvation and resurrection, immortality. It's like getting back what you fell out of when you go to paradise. Because in Greek, the word paradise means garden. Paradise is like going back to the Garden of Eden type of thing, to be like a god again, right? So that we're familiar with, but the Greeks didn't have that. They just leave it there without any clear hope. Although Hesiod does say in this poem, I hope there are kings. I hope there are just kings. Kings work for Zeus. May there be just kings on earth. So that possibly brings a little hope. Because kings came from Zeus, and Jesus was a divine king who came from God. So the Greeks were aware of some of that stuff from these other cultures, but they didn't go with that. They left it as kind of pessimistic. They didn't expect that to happen. But there are parallels with that. There are clear parallels between this and the Near Eastern culture that gave us the Savior and those ideas we were saying. So that's just a kind of a short version. I didn't want to give the whole thing, but I had to kind of say the little connection there, if that makes sense. Does that make sense? Okay. And we'll see that again one more time in the story coming up. Something similar to that. Okay, so that explains how the world is difficult. The Greeks also had a saying, Zeus has two jars, one full of goods, one full of evils. And when you're born, he takes something from each jar and mixes them together, and that is your lot. But you never know what you're going to get. You never know what combination you're going to get. That's found in Homer's Iliad. And I think that's, you know, is that a good description of the world? It's very wise, I think. I mean, it's hard to do better, you know, sometimes. It's useful sometimes. Okay, so that's what all that story is about. And then it gets into more about how the world is hard and the gods can send difficulties to people. And this is the Greek flood story that goes like this. The people are wicked. Zeus heard about the wickedness of people, the wicked ways of mankind. So Zeus came to Earth disguised to check this out. And he went to the home of Lycaon, who was a wicked king. And Lycaon was performing human sacrifice, and he was a cannibal. And he wanted to eat Zeus when he showed up as a guest in human disguise. You're not supposed to do this, right? By the way, remember in that story last time from the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is a variant Hebrew account that's not in the Bible but found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. People were cannibals, and that's why God sent the flood. And that's what happens here. Zeus finds he's a cannibal. So Zeus says, you should be good to a guest, because a guest may be Zeus in disguise. Which, by the way, Jesus says at one point. This was how the gods watch over morality. It's become a little more social, by the way, a little more than we've said so far. That as you get into people more, you say, why should we be good? Well, maybe Zeus will punish you. Maybe not, you don't know. But one thing the Greeks were concerned with was hospitality. Be good to a guest because it might be good, because it might be Zeus in disguise. So that comes into this story. In other words, it includes a social message, a little more justice here from the gods. Okay? So Zeus reveals himself. Be careful, it's really Zeus. And he turns Lycaon into a werewolf. This is one of the only werewolves in Greek and Roman mythology. The word wolf is Luke, the L-U-K part, Lukas. That's in his name. And Lycaon turns into a werewolf, and there's a word called lycanthropy, that's an English word for werewolves. That's wolfman, lycanthrope. Okay, and Zeus says, let people pay the penalty they deserve. So he's going to wipe out people and bring about a new and better race of people, which is also kind of biblical. You see something similar in the Apocalypse story, the last book of the New Testament, right? It's so wicked it will be destroyed. We'll get the new world come in and all that. So Zeus can't use thunderbolts because then the world will be destroyed totally. And who would sacrifice to the gods? They need people to work for the gods and feed the gods through offerings. So he sends the flood. He sends the great flood. And this is in the next generation after Prometheus and Pandora. Prometheus has a son, Deucalion, and his brother and Pandora, that is Epimetheus and Pandora, are the parents of Pyrrha. So Deucalion and Pyrrha are married, and they are good, and they're the ones who are saved. That's like the Greek Noah. They're good. They're the best and most pious people. They're saved for being good. So they build a ship. They land on top of Mount Parnassus, which is not the worst place to land. It's a beautiful mountain right above Delphi. It's the home of the Muses. Now it's a skiing resort in Greece. And so they're the survivors. Deucalion and Pyrrha are like the Greek Noah. Although here the woman is named, by the way, in all these Noah stories. Noah has a wife, but she's never named. And then Neptune has a son, Triton, recall the waters by blowing through a shell. And they're standing atop of the mountain. And now what do? So they pray to a goddess, and they get an oracle. Toss the bones of your mother over your shoulders. Well, what the Hades is that, right? So they have to figure it out. Because the gods riddle, the ways of gods are not clear to people. It's hard for people to understand the world. So you have all these ambiguous oracles. It's a puzzle. And so they pick up rocks and throw it over their shoulders, and these rocks turn into people. So the rocks are the bones of your mother, Mother Earth. The solution to the riddle is the bones of your Mother Earth over your shoulders, is to throw these rocks over your shoulders, in other words. And the rocks turn into people. In Greek, the word stone is spelled a lot like the word people, so it's a little pun. And maybe that says something about human nature, if we're from these rocks. We're tough, enduring, we're from earth, we're not spiritual, we're not from heaven, we're not like gods. That was like these Mesopotamian stories from before. Okay, so then they become the ancestors of everybody, Deucalion and Pyrrha. So by the way, everybody's descended from Pandora. She's the first woman. That's the mother of Pyrrha, the survivor of the flood. And so this is why Pandora nowadays is a feminist symbol. It's very ironic, since that story was very negative about bad things coming with Pandora. Now she's a feminist symbol as the first woman. Okay, so Deucalion and Pyrrha have a son named Helen with two L's. Who's named after Helen? it's a male name with two L's. All the Greeks, the Hellenes. Hellenes are the Greeks. That's what they still call themselves. Greeks is not a Greek word. When we say Greeks, that's what the Romans called them, from Latin, Graeci. So Helen is made up to be the ancestor of all the Greeks. He's the eponym of the Greeks, the person the Greeks are named after. That's called an eponymous ancestor, and that's clearly made up. People make these things up to try to explain their origin. And Helen had three sons, and these are the ancestors of the Dorians, the Ionians, and the Aeolians, who were three ethnicities within Greece. You know, there are Doric columns, Ionic columns. These were also dialects, Doric and Ionic. And the Dorians were Sparta, the Ionians were Athens, and Ionia in Turkey. So they saw themselves also as different, and sometimes they were at war with each other. So these were ethnic divisions within Greece. But they knew they were all Greek, so they said they were all from Helen, but then they branched off in those three divisions. It's a little different than the Hebrew, by the way, because in Hebrew, Noah has three sons, but they're the ancestors of everybody. Japheth is the ancestor of the Europeans, Ham is the ancestor of Africans, and Shem is the ancestor of Shemites. So the Hebrews more are the center of the world around them, whereas here the Greeks are just explaining the Greeks and not the whole world. But it's, you know, all these stories are ethnocentric anyway, but they're both just as ethnocentric. Okay, so that's the flood story. Now, where did the Greeks get the flood story? Would the Greeks imagine a flood? Well, it's possible to imagine because people make up stories, and we said the flood is maybe people's fears of going back to the primal waters, of turning back the universe to the earlier stages of chaos. So it could be that fear that this is going to wipe out all creation, right? But in Greece, maybe you would not think of a flood, right? We said this last time, that it doesn't rain. It's the opposite. You pray for rain. It's really dry. There are no navigable rivers, really. And this story is clearly passed down. It's a literary tradition that went from Sumer to Babylon to the Hebrews to the Greeks and then to the Romans. So the Greeks clearly got this from these older stories, and that would be an argument saying that this flood story doesn't mean there was an historical flood. This is a story that was passed down. Okay. Well, about this whole period we're talking about, of how there are gods and then the first people who are in a state living with the gods and then fall from that state and decline. The Greeks have another story about that. It's kind of parallel to these past recent periods we've been talking about. A story of decline. And notice how this is all very pessimistic. Things are good in the beginning, and you decline. That the Greeks never said, you know, it will get better. There's no salvation. So they had another way to say that whole picture like we've just had. That's another story Hesiod gives called The Myth of the Five Ages, which is his story here, that there are five ages of mankind. The first was the age of gold. The Golden Age. This was presided over by Cronus, who in Latin is Saturn. And in Latin they called it the Age of Saturn. In the Golden Age, people lived like gods. They had no labor, no sorrow. That would be like this stage in the Prometheus story. Again, these are kind of two parallel stories, now kind of going back and parallel to what we've had for a while. It'd be like the first stage in the Prometheus story when people and gods are dining together. Or like the Garden of Eden, or various stories of this kind of utopian state before the fall. There are myths of Arcadia in European literature, like that too. But people fall from that. There's a progressive decline. The next age is the age of silver. They are more violent. They want sacrifice to the gods. And at some point here you have the transition from Cronus being the ruling god to Zeus being the ruling god. And the third age is the age of bronze. They are warlike. The fourth is the age of heroes. These are the heroes of Greek legend. Hercules, Achilles, all them. Some of them were so good they got to live forever at some island beyond the world, like we saw with Dilmun before. But the fifth age is the worst of all. There's a progressive decline into the Iron Age, from Golden Age to Iron Age. The Iron Age is what we live in now. Hesiod says, "Oh, I wish I did not live in the fifth generation." This is after Pandora has brought the evils. Everybody fights with each other. People have to work hard. They get sick. They die in war. They lie. They cheat each other. They want money. All they care about is money. They don't care about each other anymore. Every generation says this, right? Well, he thought that's when it started. That it's so wicked. And Hesiod says, "I wish I did not live in this fifth generation, the age of iron. Zeus will destroy this generation because of its wickedness." And that sounds a little biblical. That's at the end of the Bible. Things will be so wicked. We'll have an apocalypse. We'll just wipe this whole world out. That's what the Bible calls for, by the way, to destroy the world and replace it with a new world, right? To live with the God, to be gods, basically, right? Now, we said the Greeks don't have that. The Greeks basically stopped there. This is the age of iron. We don't know if there's hope. We don't know if there's salvation. But there are these Near Eastern parallel stories where it does go that way, that we know from the Bible. Okay, so that's a pattern we can talk about a little bit more. Okay, so for the Greeks, we're in the age of iron. All the evils have been released from Pandora's jar, and there's hope inside, but we don't know what that means for us, like we said. So that's the real world. Pessimism, no clear progress, no salvation. But we know that a similar story is found in the ancient Near East. And there's something in the Old Testament in the book of Daniel, which is from 164 or 166 B.C. It's the last written book of the Old Testament. And here there's a prophecy of a beast with these different metals. And it mentions these different metals and from Egyptian and other things. It seems this is an older pattern that Hesiod partly got from them. And in other words, this would be why it's a pattern found in the Bible and in Hesiod, and you can compare them both as an ancient pattern that actually these cultures actually had connections. Because look at Hesiod's account of the five ages: gold, silver, bronze, heroes, iron. What's funny about that? If you were going to make up five generations, right? Yeah, why aren't they all five metals? Heroes is anomalous. Heroes is something you put in there because he had the four metals. And then somebody said, "Well, what about the heroes? What about Achilles and all these people? Where are they?" And he says, "Okay, here are the heroes," because the Greeks had that, right? And so the metals are something older he got, because we have evidence for this that you could, you know, it's really a matter of research, digging it up, but there are traces of it in the book of Daniel and in other places in the Near East. That is an older pattern. So we said the Greeks leave it there, but the way the Bible goes is, in the last book of the Bible, you will have or in the New Testament, and culminating in the last book of the Bible, God will send his Son, and God will come down to earth, who is the divine king, right? The anointed one. That's what Messiah means, or Christ means, anointed by the king, anointed by God. And he will be the savior to restore people from this miserable state of the earth and mortality and death and destruction. And that whole world will be destroyed. And he will bring us back. Right? He will bring us back to Eden. The Savior. Now, these really are similar ideas. Here's another way we still have this today. Okay, Christmas, we celebrate the birth of the Savior who will restore this. The Romans had a festival in the middle of December, around December 17th. For a few days, they had a holiday called the Saturnalia. Saturnalia is the holiday of Saturn. Saturn is the Roman name for Cronus. And the age of Saturn was the Golden Age. So in the Saturnalia in Rome, you would celebrate like it's the Golden Age. You would love everybody. You would have brotherhood. In other words, you erase these social distinctions of people fighting with each other and enslaving each other and cheating each other for money. That's in the real world. And in the festival, you act out something more ideal. The slaves are free for this holiday, and everybody celebrates together. It's a type of brotherhood, a return to these early conditions before the separation occurred. And they would give gifts to each other. Well, this festival, the Saturnalia, is a lot like Christmas, right, which celebrates the Savior who will restore us to that kind of state. And it's not a coincidence, because why is Christmas celebrated at December 25th? Was Jesus born on December 25th? No. Does anybody know when Jesus was born?
September.
Nobody knows. Even September would be a guess. Well, maybe you want it to be the same day as your birthday. Well, nobody knew. Actually, the early church celebrated March, and nobody knew. You know, they give these stories of his birth, but they're already kind of legendary stories written many decades after his life. And why is it December 25th? Because at one point, the early bishops said, okay, these Romans have the Saturnalia festival. They're never going to give up that festival. How can we get them to come to Christianity? Okay, we'll make a festival there so they'll come to our festival and leave that one. And they made it deliberately, and they said that themselves. And they said, we'll put Christmas here to rival the Saturnalia and draw them over. Okay, so that's well known, actually, that happened. But here's the thing I'm saying a little more, that it was not just their cynical way to get converts, to try to deceive you to go from one to the other, but that they really were related. These festivals have common ideas, and this common notion from this ancient pattern we're talking about, of the Golden Age being restored. The Greeks didn't think you would have a savior. They were pessimistic. But these ancient patterns, which were in the neighboring peoples that we get in the Bible, they said there was more to the story. The Savior would come and improve it all. So we get that at Christmas, and then Romans acted it out in the Saturnalia, but didn't think it had actually happened the way the Bible does. If that makes sense, okay. So so a lot of that I made it myself. Well, notice that religions are based on myths. Religions are based on stories from the ancient world. Noah's Ark, the manger, all this, they're stories. And it's hard for us to know what the actual history is, but the point is, no, it's about history, it's about these theological messages, just like the Greek stories are. Okay, so that's Greek creation stories and the first people, and next time we'll talk about Greek gods and goddesses, after that heroes, and the Trojan War. So we have time for questions. Yes?
What was the snake in the picture of Prometheus and Atlas? What did that signify?
That's with Atlas. Well, snakes are not all bad in myth. There are stories about a snake in the far west. That refers to the far west where there was a garden of the Hesperides with a snake guarding this special tree. And that's like if you go across the water to a garden of the gods, that comes up in some of the hero stories. Actually, Hercules has to go there at one point. I think it refers to that. But one thing, if you're interested in snakes, they're not negative.
Not really.
They're usually earth regeneration, like in Gilgamesh, it sheds its skin, it gets the plant of youth. They refer to the earth and sometimes healing. And they're not all negative. We think they're negative because of the Garden of Eden story and because people are afraid of snakes. And so it's a surprise to see the very positive. That's right, it's actually the doctor. Yeah, Dr. Frankenstein. Uh-huh.
Why did Pandora open the jar?
Oh, okay, this is a good question. Actually, really, why did Pandora open the jar? Well, really the gods are sending this. The gods give this. Now, what a lot of people will say is curiosity was at fault. You read children's versions, or all these retellings of these myths, and we'll often retell it to say, curiosity was the sin. She shouldn't have looked, or Epimetheus should have heeded the warning. That's not really the Greek message. The Greek message is the God send this, so there's nothing you can do. So that's, in other words, part of the making. That's just the way they made Pandora, was to bring this. That's, the God sent it to you. It's not all about gender either. That's there, but not the overriding thing, I would say. Because nowadays we think curiosity is a sin. We'll say, oh, Adam and Eve, their curiosity led to the fall. This is not a Greek message. This is a biblical message. In the Bible, knowledge is shameful. They're ashamed of their knowledge. They cover up, and they don't want knowledge. And the message is, don't know too much. Don't put your nose into God's business, because that's not your business as people. The Bible never praises knowledge, really, right? But the Greeks do. The Greeks are different. The Greeks didn't think curiosity was a sin. So when people retell Pandora that way, it's really through this Christian tradition of curiosity and types of illegal knowledge.
What's your question? There wasn't email in those days. How do the scholars account for the similarity of the stories across ages and geography, the flood and the mountain and the separation of the sky and the earth, again and again and again?
Yeah, well, these are all neighboring cultures which were in contact. So these ones we have, you know, this is not the whole world, so this is possible to explain it as context. We have Egypt, Mesopotamia, and Greece, and Rome has some similarities. So this could have passed through neighbors. And there's one other, and there's clear signs that Hesiod and this period of Greek literature, say the 8th century BC, that they adopted some elements from the Near East. They got the alphabet from that area too. Well, yeah, but they, yeah, but that's not impossible. But also, with the Greeks coming in, they were related by ancestry to these Indo-European groups, or various other groups of people who were also Indo-Europeans. So that's another way things come in. Many people have a sky god, for example. And actually, that's a long story. During the break, somebody was saying, what about archetypes? Does everybody have this in their mind and their unconscious in human psychology? So all cultures produce this independently. That's the theory of Carl Jung and his psychology of archetypes, the unconscious, that is wired in our minds. Now notice, that starts with mythology. That's a way to explain the similarities of mythology. Mythology leads to psychology and biology. Right? So that's just a theory. There's many ways to take that. But this is all of closely related people who were in contact and they're spreading around here. So this is not a miracle or hard to explain.
Uh-huh.
Well, that would be like the Far East. That would be like the edge of the known world for the Greeks, because they have the Black Sea and then the Caspian Sea, and they didn't know much past that. And no seas might be the ocean that's around the whole earth. You know, they knew about the Persian Gulf at times, they knew about India too, but it's like a symbol for the Far East.
Did the Greeks believe in an afterlife for man, for mortals?
Well, not really. You go to Hades and you're like a shade, but you're dead and it's not you because you don't really have your body. You're like a ghost and you're miserable because you're dead. So death is death. So not really, no. It was nothing good. It was nothing positive. We can say more later. Next time, okay? Or in two times to talk, the last two times to talk about heroes. That comes up a lot there, what heroes want to get. But not really. It's not like we expect. But it's the origins of our views about that. Yes.
Well,
okay. Well, that's a good question. Well, hope could be negative. It's possible to say because this is all evil, hope itself is an evil. Because for the Greeks, this was often negative. It's a false hope, a delusion, since they didn't really have a hope of better, you know? So some people take it that way. Good question. Or it could be just a trick, deceiving people and it's in the jar. Okay, it's always out of your reach, right?
Issue of the flood, which appears in many cultures. The story about the land bridge between the Mediterranean across the Dardanelles, and is that the Black Sea?
Yeah.
That caused the local flooding. Is there any basis to that?
Well, that's straight geology. People wrote a book about this a few years ago, about the geology of how the Black Sea was formed in this early event. I don't remember when it was, you know, thousands of years BC. And they titled it Noah's, The Truth Behind Noah's Flood or whatever, something like that, to try to sell a lot of copies. Well, I don't believe this myself, and I think that flood stories don't have to be historical, but we want these stories to be historical. But notice, they're stories, and history is a lot different than the stories. You can never prove all the things in these stories. But we want to, because our culture and our religion goes back to them, and we see it as a formative time. So I don't think that explains the flood story, because it starts in Sumer, and if it was a real local thing, it would have been there. But to me, it's like this. You know, on Valentine's Day, they'll have an article in the paper, well, what is it like being in love? Well, if you eat a lot of chocolate, scientists see that this happens in your brain, and it's just like being in love. So being in love is like eating a lot of chocolate. Does that explain being in love? No. So does this geology of something that happened explain the flood stories? I don't think so, but people, you know, that's what people often, they often like the type of thinking. But let's think about our thinking and our assumptions.
Why were the Greeks appear to be so pessimistic, and the Jews not that far away appear to be so optimistic?
Well, they're not totally different, because in the Old Testament, there's no clear hope for immortality of the individual going to heaven or individual immortality, life after death. This is not in the Old Testament. People are surprised about that. Job says, I'm suffering, I'm going to be rewarded by God, but no less talk about how God will reward him. It's about getting more stuff. There's never anything about living on. He knows he's going to die. And in the Old Testament, they have like Sheol, a dark place where the shades go, that's similar to Hades. There's no mortality in the Bible. The Hebrews only got this in the 3rd and 2nd centuries B.C. The Pharisees got this, and some scholars think they got that from Plato and Greek views of immortality that developed from Greek philosophy, and Plato promoted that. So it's with the New Testament, so it's something that came between the Old Testament and the New Testament. The Old Testament view is darker, and there are many comparisons with this type of God. God hates people. God can wipe out people. This is not really positive. God can decide to destroy all people just because he wants to. Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's right.
They get exiled,
okay.
And then when they clean up their act, they can come back to be.
That's right. That's right. Then there's all these messages, just be good. Right. God will be good to you. If you're good and pious, God will be better to you. It develops a more of a moral message there, but it's still not life after death, really.
Why is it so different? I mean, how far apart are these people?
100
miles or
100
miles?
I don't know
what the distance is.
Yeah. Well.
No answer.
It's hard. I think there are a lot of similarities. But the Jews developed more faith in God and more of a view of God acting in the world for their own benefit.
Well, one is monotheistic and the other is pantheist.
Polytheist, you mean? Sure. I think there are a lot of similarities, but it's true there are obvious differences. And but within Greek, there's also the evolution to God's becoming more just, and then philosophers thinking God's a really spiritual monotheistic. And after all, Christianity is written in Greek and gets a lot of these ideas from Greek thought, right? The New Testament is in Greek, so there's a whole Greek progression you could say from this to that. So it's a long story. There's differences and similarities, but sometimes more similarities that would surprise you. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.